This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. My guest today is the one and only Naomi Klein, who first came to our attention with her book, No Logo, and then last year she came out with her blockbuster book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. She's also done a film on Argentina's worker-occupied factories, and she's a columnist for The Nation magazine and The Guardian. Naomi Klein, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Oh, it's great to see you again. Tell me, we're pretty fresh off this election. What was your reaction to Obama's victory?
Well, I made a really conscious choice that I was going to enjoy the night, you know, because I think that these, obviously, I am keenly aware and was keenly aware of what a centrist Obama is, and that there would be lots of disappointments that would follow. But that doesn't negate the fact of the evening and the power of the evening. And so I have some like really hardcore anarchist friends, and I told them, I'm like, listen, you are not taking this night away from me. I will not hear it the night of. And because I was in Washington, D.C., and you know, it was a fantastic night in D.C. because the main thing that I felt that night was it was the night that the service sector owned the city.
How so?
Well, just because I have a lot of trouble with D.C. I spend a lot of time there because my husband works there, and you know, it's a city, particularly where we are, which is right around the White House, and you know, on H Street, and it's. You know, you'd be having a perfectly nice meal and look over and, you know, it'd just be overhearing a conversation between, you know, a lobbyist and a judge. And you know, one time we went into a restaurant and it really wasn't even that fancy. And Karl Rove and Ben Stein were there.
Oh,
and, you know, so it's just it's a city where there's a phrase in French about even about that means it's ça se passe sur le visage, which means they carry it on their face. You can see it on their face, and you can sort of see the corruption in people's faces. But so that night, I was walking to the apartment where my husband stays, and passing by this really elite sort of storied club that shall remain nameless. And you know, the only way I can describe this club, I always look in the window and you know, there's no sign or anything, but it looks like the type of place where like Central American coups are plotted and judges are bribed by the tobacco industry. And you just see these like very red faced sort of scotch addled men walking in and out. And on this night, and this was 11:30, a half an hour after the results were announced, there were these two African-American men, both wearing uniforms, high-fiving each other and sort of hooting outside this private club. And one of them was the doorman of this private club, and one of them was a chauffeur for one of the members of the club. And so as I was passing, one of the club members, and this was right after the results were announced, came out of the club looking just miserable. And he was sort of like a Daddy Warbucks character, you know? And he comes out of the club with just an absolute scowl on his face. And I watch, you know, these two men who had just been celebrating, you know, go back to their post. One of them opens the door for him for the club, and the other one opens the door of the waiting limousine, and they like share this smile. And I just thought, wow, you know, this is a night where the people holding open the doors are just having a way better time than the people walking through the doors, and that's pretty rare in that city.
It was, that's the two Washingtons, it's the two Americas, and the one America without power at least could relish the moment. And
yeah.
You know, Ralph Nader has been criticizing many on the progressive side for not coming on board his campaign or Cynthia McKinney's Green campaign. Excuse me. How do you respond to that critique?
You know, I would have loved for Ralph to be Ralph and Cynthia to have been in the debates. I think, you know, when particularly when this campaign became a referendum about deregulation, wouldn't it have been amazing to have had Ralph in the mix talking about Glass-Steagall and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act? And, you know, he is the country's foremost consumer protector, and he knows this stuff inside and out, and it would have been so important to have his voice there. you know, I think it would have been great to have his voice. You know, I'm not sure. I was actually wondering whether, in some ways, whether Ralph got less airtime because he was running for president than he would have had he been just Ralph Nader, private citizen, in this moment when deregulation was the issue of the day. At any rate, I think Ralph has some very legitimate points to make about the way he was sidelined by progressive media. I know he feels that way about The Nation.
Oh, and The Progressive. He's criticized me and the magazine by name several times.
I don't know. I don't really quite know what to say because, you know, Ralph decided to run for president. I don't know how. I don't know what the process led to that. I asked him directly. I didn't really get much of an answer, which is simply to say that, you know, like this expectation that we're all going to line up behind Ralph when he decides to run, but none of us understand how he's making the decisions or any of the strategy behind it because he's not, there isn't a democratic, transparent process that we can see that we're included in, is the reason why I'm not that excited about it and why I wasn't that excited about it. And I said to Ralph that what excited me about 2000 when I did support him was that there was an amazing intersection between a grassroots social movement that was outing the two-party system, that was focused on campaign finance reform, that was focused on media reform, that for president, it was about a moment. And it was about that intersection between social movements and a political candidacy. And that's what interests me, you know, in somebody like Evo Morales or somebody like Rafael Correa in Ecuador, where you have that intersection between, you know, new social movements and a new kind of a political party. But there has to be democracy and transparency in the process.
What kind of movement do you think there is behind Obama, or is there no movement there? And how do progressives hold him accountable?
Well, that remains to be seen. I think we're in uncharted territory here with the Obama machine. It's a very weird mix between the most elite corporate funding, Wall Street funding, and the most grassroots, small scale, and kind of community organizing models. And these two forces brought Obama to power. And it's weird, you know, a genuinely grassroots movement combining with, you know, Ken Griffin from Citadel, you know, a billionaire hedge fund manager and Goldman Sachs. I mean,
is the community organizer going to win out, or is the collector from Wall Street going to win out?
Well, you know, a lot of people have made this point recently, just that, you know, when you ignite that kind of energy, you can't necessarily control it. That said, there are networks that mobilize, you know, 100,000 people in the stadium to come see Obama, you know, again and again. And those are networks, those are lists, you know, as we know, you know, this is how organizing happens. And the Obama campaign has the lists, not anybody else. I mean, you know, the labor movement has their lists and Move On has their lists. But the real machine is the Obama campaign machine. And, you know, I think at this point, I wrote a piece, like The Guardian asked me for, you know, three sentences on, you know, what's your advice for the new president? And I said, free your base and the rest will follow. Which is that, you know, I do feel that Obama is sending sort of a mixed message because he's saying, you know, I'm going to need you. But what does that mean? Does that mean that Obama's going to be calling more rallies of hundreds of thousands of people to come and put pressure on him? No sitting president calls rallies to protest themselves. So there has to be a way to break free from that electoral machine and become an independent movement. You know, when you have something like Move On, which made itself a part of the Obama machine, but is technically independent, you know, that it's entirely within their power to decide tomorrow that they are now going to use this energy to say, you know, no to Larry Summers as Treasury Secretary or something that, you know, is really getting in the face of the reformist agenda or the race to the so-called center that we're seeing already from the Obama campaign. They could do that. And they could say, you know, now we want a real withdrawal from Iraq. And no, we don't want escalation in Afghanistan. And if we run out of money for our Green New Deal, then slash defense funding. They can use their infrastructure to do that. I don't think that they will.
I'm speaking with Naomi Klein. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine. What do you make of this group of corporatists and Clinton retreads that are surrounding Obama now on the economic front?
I would say it's disappointing, but we don't have a right to be disappointed in the sense that this is who surrounded Obama during the whole campaign. His chief economic advisor is Jason Furman, who distinguished himself by attacking Barbara Ehrenreich for calling for a living wage for Walmart workers, which Jason Furman argued was bad for poor people because lower prices were more important. And I bring this up because actually Jason Furman's not known for a lot of things. I mean, he doesn't have a very extensive publishing record. I mean, his highest profile writings have been in defense of Walmart, and this is who Obama chose two days after Hillary dropped out of the race and conceded to Obama. He chose that moment to appoint Furman. And he's been taking advice from Larry Summers and Bob Rubin and Paul Volcker all along. Now, he's opened up the circle a little bit to people like Stiglitz, Robert Reich, maybe a little bit Dean Baker, and that's a good sign. But to me, it's just shocking. And like I said, we shouldn't be shocked. But it's just shocking to me that Larry Summers is being treated as the front runner for Treasury Secretary. And even more shocking to me, frankly, and I don't know how to say this in a politically correct way, but even more shocking to me is that the main thing that people are objecting to is what he said at Harvard about women, which was, about women's aptitude in science, which was an offensive thing to say. And he lost his job in part over it, or left the job. But that to me is so much less of a crime than the fact that he was the main architect in Treasury for the shock therapy program in Russia that impoverished 60 million people, did a lot of harm to women there too, and played a key role in the shock therapy in Thailand, in South Korea during the Asian economic crisis in 1998. I quote him in my book. I start the Russia chapter with a quote from Summers saying, spread the truth, the same rules. The rules of economics are like the rules of engineering. The same rules work everywhere. That was 1992, and that was his rationale for imposing privatization, deregulation, cuts to social spending in Russia. He cheerled Boris Yeltsin as he attacked the Russian parliament, dissolved democracy, suspended the constitution, and imposed shock therapy. And that led to the creation of the Russian oligarchs. At the same time, he defended the Harvard boys, the Harvard men, who were insider trading in this period, profiting from the privatizations and deregulation that they themselves were creating. So he has a dismal track record, and he is, and this doesn't even begin to say that he was standing by Clinton's side and introduced him when Clinton abolished Glass-Steagall, which is the key piece of legislation that would have prevented the financial crisis that we're seeing right now. He fought tooth and nail alongside Alan Greenspan to prevent the derivatives industry from being regulated. And I think the reason why I'm so upset about this is because I feel that we're paying the price for the deliberate amnesia that we've all sort of signed on to, or that so many of us have signed on to during the Bush years, where we're allowed to say whatever we want critical about the U.S. policy, even about the free market, as long as we pretend it all started in 2000 when Bush took office. It's this deal. Sorry, 2001. So if we have to say it, and it's like Obama's campaign was the ultimate example of this. This crisis that we're seeing is the result of the deregulation policies that have been in place for the past 8 years. No, not 8 years. The key pieces of legislation were passed under Clinton, and we all turned the other way, and we allowed these lies to be repeated. And we thought, we'll just get rid of Bush and let them have their strategy, and the strategy works. Well, this is the result of the strategy. The result of the strategy is that Larry Summers is treated like the savior of the economy.
Speaking with Naomi Klein, she is the author, of course, of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. This is Progressive Radio. I mean, surely Obama, who is an intelligent man, knows that litany that you recited. I'm just wondering why you would think him knowing that, he would still go with someone and associate with you know, the Rubens and the Summers. Is it that's where he is politically, which very well may be, or is he trying to please the mainstream pundits and power establishment that feel reassured by this? Is he trying to keep Wall Street happy? What's your sense?
I don't think that politicians make the kind of bold risks that we really need in this moment. And, you know, people are talking about a Green New Deal and comparing this moment to the early 30s. And I think that those analogies are right. But what led FDR to take those risks and be that bold was that he was under enormous pressure from grassroots movements from below. So this comes back to what we were talking about earlier. You know, where is that pressure coming from? Because I think in the absence of it, he's under tremendous pressure not to shock the system, right? And this is the logic. And, in my book, in The Shock Doctrine, you know, I talk about market shocks and the disciplining effect of market shocks. I don't think we should play down the fact that the market did plunge after Obama was elected. I mean, election day, there was a rally, but it's been plunging ever since. And that's incredibly traumatic for a leader. In a moment of market volatility, the analogy, you know, in the book, I have a chapter on South Africa, and this is what happened to Mandela. He walked out of prison, and the currency, the rand, plummeted, and the market started betting against freedom and democracy.
And said every time he talked about nationalization, it would go down another 5 or 10%.
Exactly. And the same thing happened with Lula in Brazil. When Lula was, you know, the closer Lula would come to victory during the presidential elections in Brazil, the more the real would plummet. And I think there's very few political leaders who can withstand watching their success translate into a political, an economic failure like that. I actually think Obama has something going for him in this moment, which is that the market's been going nuts before any of this, right? So it's actually not that shocking for the Dow to plunge on any given day. I think what we have to accept that if he were to appoint Joseph Stiglitz, who's I've been, you know, in my fantasy world, he's my ideal Treasury Secretary, okay? If you were to appoint Joseph Stiglitz, the market would plummet, right? I mean, this is why he's not doing it, right? And so without a counterpressure, without a social movement demanding it, right? And that incredible FDR quote, you know, now go out and make me do it, right? That dynamic that allowed FDR to sell the New Deal as a compromise. Of course, he's not going to do something that's going to send the market plunging. The market wants Larry Summers. The market wants continuity. The market wants to know that it's the same club. And that volatility, I think, is very, very scary. And I think only a really bold social movement, labor-led, environmental-led, would have the guts to say, yeah, the market's going to go crazy for a little while. But you know what? It was going crazy before. And then we're going to get on a better course.
He also has in his favor that, you know, Bush started this so-called nationalization of the banks, or at least paved part of the way there. You wrote an article recently in The Nation magazine critiquing the bailout. What's your critique of it?
Well, I've written a couple articles about it, one for Rolling Stone called The Bailout Profiteers, which is actually a more extensive article, not just about the terms of that have been negotiated with the banks, but the specifics of the contracts. Because, you know, what I'm arguing is that actually this bailout is the Bush administration's last trough, much like the Iraq War, where, you know, they treat these big government programs as essentially cash machines, where private companies withdraw funds and pay them back in the form of campaign contributions. And that's the way the Iraq War has been waged. That's the way the war on terror has been waged. And now the bailout is the new trough. And so you have this $700 billion. It's much more than $700 billion if you count AIG, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the FDIC guarantees. I mean, according to the New York Times, if all of this, if all of the risk that has been taken on actually comes to a stunning $4 trillion. That's if you lose all of these investments. But anyway, let's call it $700 billion.
It's a lot of money.
Let's call it $700 billion for now. So they announced the bailout plan. They announced that Neil Kashkari will be in charge, who's a former Goldman Sachs banker, 6 years away out of his MBA, unbelievably inexperienced for this job. I mean, just insultingly so. And of course, fitting with this, and this is where it really reminds me of the Green Zone in Iraq, announces that, of course, they can't do the bailout themselves because they don't have the skills, presumably, and this is the Bush specialty of just treating government as an opportunity to privatize your own job, outsource your the work of government to be done for a profit. And to me, this is just as a side, you know, this amazes me because they fill the Treasury with, you know, Goldman Sachs bankers and, you know, Bear Stearns bankers and you know, because they have Wall Street experience, we're told. But then when they actually have to make deals, they say, well, we can't do this ourselves. We have to contract it out. So
and who do they contract it out to?
Who do they contract it out to? Well, they hired a law firm, Simpson, Bartler & Thatcher, which is just the quintessential Wall Street law firm. And I did some research and it turns out that the first nine banks, Simpson Thatcher was brought in to negotiate the equity deals with the nine banks, and then all the banks that followed. But they were brought in right before that, and Simpson Thatcher had represented seven of those nine banks around the table. And I got the contract from Treasury. I asked, what are the conflict of interest guidelines on this contract? And they sent me something that said that Simpson Thatcher agreed not to represent any of these banks in these negotiations. So they can't represent both sides, obviously, but they can still represent those banks when they apply to Treasury for other parts of the bailout.
Oh, that's a sweet deal.
It's
the conflict of interest was there writ large always with Goldman Sachs and Paulson anyway.
Yeah, of course.
And
I mean, absolutely everything.
And people just kind of blinded their eyes to that. I wanted to ask you also about Alan Greenspan. You've debated.
Well, I mean, the other point about the bailout is that's the reason why it's striking that the firm that was the law firm that was negotiating these equity deals has worked for seven of the nine banks is that, you know, you can see the result in the deal that they ended up with, which is an incredibly bad deal. We know how bad it is because 5 days earlier, Gordon Brown negotiated a deal with several British banks to purchase equity in exchange for a capital injection, and he got 12% return on investment annually. He got a seat on the board, voting rights, and he got guarantees that they would use the capital injection to lend money to small businesses and homeowners. So 5 days later, Henry Paulson and this Wall Street law firm come up with their terms, 5% as opposed to 12%, no voting rights, no seats on the board, and no guarantee that the money will be spent doing what they say it's supposed to be doing, which is to get liquidity going, to get lending going.
And that was one of the biggest scandals because then it came out that J.P. Morgan Chase was not going to use any of this money to lend to other companies.
Citi said that they were going to use it on acquisitions. They were going to use it for mergers. And it's clear that a huge amount of it is going to be going to shareholders and a huge amount is going to be going to bonuses.
And can that be renegotiated?
Well, I mean, what I'm arguing is, first of all, Obama should never have signed the bailout deal. It was always just, you know, to me, just on a democratic level, an aberration, you know.
Abomination.
An abomination. He did not just vote for the bailout, but he championed the bailout. He heard from his base. I mean, I spoke to somebody who works the phones in Obama headquarters in Chicago, and the day after Obama voted for the bailout, they got more negative calls by far than at any point during the campaign. So he knows that he took that risk, and he knows that it was very, very unpopular. The New York Times has argued that the bailout did an editorial a couple days before the election was sort of lost, arguing that the bailout funds should now be frozen. Nothing more should be handed out because this is not the deal it's not the deal that was sold to the public. The deal that was sold to the public was capital injection in order to encourage lending. These are healthy banks. This is what the weirdest part about the deal is that they're saying that the only banks that are getting the money are banks that are healthy, but they're not asking anything in return. So it's just free money. It's absolute madness. So Obama despite the fact that he'd made that terrible calculation during the campaign, he actually has the leeway now to say that this is not the bailout that he voted for, because the New York Times is saying it now. Barney Frank is starting to say it. So there's a loophole if he wants out, and I don't think he'll take it unless he faces huge pressure from the same people who called him and told him it was a bad deal to begin with. But, you know, the stakes of this are so huge, because if this is a bad deal, it's a hugely expensive deal. You know, I was just struck by just watching a little clip of Obama talking about how his plan, his big Green New Deal, right, investments in alternative energy, and by the way, far too much of it is nuclear and coal, is $150 billion. AIG got that much, right? So, I mean, think about $700 billion. Think about the kind of money that we're talking about just throwing away for no reason. Then the right turns around as soon as Obama comes to office, or well before, they're starting now, and says, yeah, about all that yes, we can stuff. No, you can't, because we're broke. We've left you this economic catastrophe, right? So, we all have a huge stake in stopping this heist. But, you know, this is part of what I argue in the book, is that moments of rapid political transition are golden opportunities for the disaster capitalists, because our eyes are focused on the big P politics, right? Everybody wants to know who the next appointment is going to be, and, you know, all of this sort of political intrigue of electoral politics, this sort of palace wars, and we're not looking at the economics.
That was the lesson in your book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism in Many Countries, especially in South Africa, a real tragic story. I'd wanted to ask you about Alan Greenspan, just because you tangled with him before, about his notorious comment now at testimony at Congress, "I found a flaw in my theory." How'd you react when you heard that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an amazing moment. I mean, I think that this is an amazing moment for the left, for progressives, because the ideologues are in crisis. The ideology is truly in crisis. And it was interesting watching Henry Waxman grill, Alan Greenspan about whether it was his ideology that created that fundamental flaw, which was a question he dodged. If you listen to what Greenspan is saying, he's saying that his fundamental flaw is that he believed that the banking industry could self-regulate on derivatives because trust and reputation are important assets in the market. And he just simply, he didn't calculate for, I suppose, was just greed. Right, and that to me is honestly, it's a completely implausible story, and I can't believe people are accepting it as a story. Right, I mean, this is a man who was an Ayn Rand protege, and his whole philosophy was that greed is the primary driving force in all of humanity, and that greed is good, and that and so how could Alan Greenspan be surprised by greed? The prime regulator of the global economy for 18 years did not calculate that bankers might be greedy.
The apostle of greed didn't calculate for greed. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Naomi Klein has been my guest. She's the author, most recently, of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. Thanks for being my guest.
Thanks, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.